Hello, everyone. Welcome again to another episode of Resilient Health Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Darren Ingles. And my guest today is someone who I have admired for years and worked with probably more than a decade now, Dr. Theo Harris Theorides. He's an MD, PhD allergist and immunologist, expert in mast cells. We're going to go a deep dive about mast cells today. And he's actually been involved with a company that makes some great products that help people with mast cell activation syndrome, allergies, asthma. So Dr. Theo, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Darren, it's a real pleasure. I've always enjoyed working with you, speaking with you, and taking care of patients. And in all honesty, there's so much to talk about the mast cell that will probably lead us to maybe another one or two sessions, if you ever want to do that again.
Absolutely. We could probably have, of course, a three-day seminar on mast cells and still not cover everything, but... Sure. You know, for those who are tuning in who might not be familiar with the terms, you know, maybe just explain a little bit about what mast cells are and why are they important in our body?
Of course. So the mast cell, spelled M-A-S-T, was basically identified in 1887 by Dr. Paul Ehrlich, who was staining tissues with various dyes. And some cells, when they were covered with blue, they turned violet. And he called that from the Greek metachromasia, change in color. He did not know where the cells were, what they were doing, but he noticed under the microscope that there were many, many, many violet little dots. And he thought that those dots were feeding surrounding cells. And he used the Greek word for breast, mastos, and he called them mastocyte, thinking that they were feeding surrounding cells. That's not what they were doing. Nevertheless, he got the Nobel Prize for this and other accomplishments. Very interestingly, though, at about the same time in 1901, two scientists were operating out of the Oceanographic Museum in the Principality of Monaco, Portier and Richet, and they did a kind of experiment. There were a lot of jellyfish, men of war, down there. So they thought if they take the jellyfish tentacles, they ground them up, and they inject them into the dogs will be protected from subsequent stings. And they did that, and they had a word ready for the phenomenon. They were going to call that prophylaxis. Instead, when they did that, the dogs constricted their airways, dropped their blood pressure, and they died. So they called that anaphylaxis. So the word anaphylaxis and the mast cells were sort of discovered about the same time. But it wasn't until 1947, when the molecule histamine was discovered in mast cells, that the two came together. So we now know if the mast cells, and I'll describe them, respond violently, then you can go into what we call anaphylactic shock, where your throat closes, the bronchi constrict, you drop your blood pressure, you're likely to die. So what is a mast cell? So the mast cell is found everywhere in the body, especially in tissues exposed to the outside world, such as eyes, nose, lungs, skin, gut. And we think that they're the first responders to anything strange that is happening in the body. And primarily, they've been known to respond to a class of immunoglobulins called immunoglobulin E or IgE, who sits on specific areas on the surface of the cell called receptors and waits there for an antigen, meaning a molecule to which this immunoglobulin was made, to come and breed two or more of these sitting there IgEs. When that happens, a cascade of reactions takes place, and the mast cell that contains about 1,000 little granules explodes and releases everything. Yet, it does not die. In the laboratory, within 24 hours, everything is back ready to fire again. So here we have a cell that's like a soccer ball with about 1,000 ping pong balls, and each ping pong ball having about 100 marbles in there. And during the course of the reaction, in addition to the marbles that can come out of the granules, which is called degranulation, the muscle can make another 100 or so molecules. And what do we deal with when this happens? Well, unfortunately, we only deal with histamine which is stored in the granules, and we give drugs to block histamine after it's being released. So antihistamines. There's another class that is synthesized, it's not stored, called leukotrienes. And they're very important because they constrict the bronchi, and we have drugs to block the leukotrienes. So we literally have only two drugs for two molecules out of the 200 or so molecules that the mast cell releases. And even having said that, until about 7 years ago, there was an oxymoron because the mast cells do not circulate. They come out of the bone marrow as premature cells. They go through the blood and they go into the tissues and they mature in the tissues. But immunoglobulin E, which is considered to be the main trigger of the mast cells, is circulating. So if the mast cells are not circulating, how do they see the immunoglobulin E to bind it? And these colleagues did a wonderful set of experiments where they videotaped live vessels, and they showed that the mast cells throw filopodia through the endothelial gap, and they sense what is happening inside the lumen, and they grab immunoglobulin E. So the mast cells not only respond to the outside world, but pretty much to whatever is happening in the blood. Do we have mast cells anywhere else? Well, we have them in the brain, and we have no idea or very little idea what they do in the brain. They're found in the meninges, the three membranes that cover the skull or the brain. And very interestingly and importantly, they are found in those parts of the brain that we should be dealing with much more often than not, which is hypothalamus that regulates homeostasis, our temperature, how our organs work, et cetera. All the hormones are regulated through that because it communicates with the pituitary. They're found in the pituitary. They're found in the amygdala that regulate behavior. And they're found in the pineal gland that regulates our diurnal rhythm. So in a sense, they're found in very critical areas of the brain. However, under normal, whatever normal means, circumstances, immunoglobulin E does not cross the protective blood-brain barrier to stimulate those cells. So therefore, we have to figure out what other triggers might be available to trigger not only the mast cells in the brain, but elsewhere. And we were the first, I dare say, show that the first hormone released under stress, called corticotropin-releasing hormone, or CRH, not only is released outside the brain, not only stimulates the mast cells, and there's no histamine release, but a whole bunch of other things, but it also resets the reactivity of the mast cells to other triggers. So notoriously, we've had patients that had a history of allergic-like problems, and I kind of shake my hands because the word allergy is very restrictive. Now we use mast cell activation.
Right.
And then something happens, major trauma, major surgeries, God forbid someone dies in the family, and all of a sudden they're allergic to life, to everything. So we know that there are ways to potentially explain that, but to preempt what we might discuss later, we do not have any drugs that literally block the mast cells. The only available drug is called cromolyn. It's very difficult to dissolve. Less than 5% is absorbed from the gut. And within a few months, we keep on increasing the dose, and then it just stops working, basically. So let me stop there for now.
You know, I think it was one of my early conversations with you that I learned. I think I missed this in medical school, you know, that mast cells contain, you know, I mean, we always talk about histamine. I mean, histamine is the big player, but it's over 200 other chemicals, like you said. And it's kind of, I guess, crazy in some way. You think that some research lab out there would be looking at other targets to help block this cascade. But it makes so much sense too, because I have so many patients that take antihistamines, they take Zyrtec, Allegra, Claritin, their symptoms don't get drastically better. And it's like, well, yeah, if you only covered one out of 200 chemicals, what did the other 199 do to your tissue?
Right. We published a paper, and since then many other colleagues have, that the mast cells release a molecule called interleukin-31. This molecule is much more itchy causing or pruritogenic than histamine. But we don't measure it in the clinic, and we don't have a way to block it. Also, some peptides like something called substance B, mm-hmm. something called chemokinin 1 are released, and they actually trigger sensory nerve endings. And over the last few years, it's been shown that there's a new receptor. There are many receptors on the mast cells, the specialized areas, other than for immunoglobulin E. And this receptor is for positively charged either chemicals or natural molecules or drugs, and they trigger the mast cell through that receptor. So, for instance, wasps have something called mastoparan. This is a positively charged toxin. It does not cause an allergy, but it will cause anaphylactic shock because it will stimulate the mast cells through this receptor. And many companies are actively looking to block this receptor as a way of maybe blocking the mast cell more broadly than just an allergic response.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned the definition of allergy. I want to address this briefly because, you know, this is an argument I've had with, I'll say, my other conventional allergy colleagues out there. You know, in the United States in particular, allergy is like a very strict definition. If it's not IgE mediated, it's not allergy. So people go to their allergist, they get skin prick testing or do RAS testing, and they say, well, nothing came up. You have no allergies. It's like, yeah, but every time it rains, I get a headache, I get congested. They have the clinical features. You know, are there other immune mechanisms involved that we're kind of defining as right. allergy that don't fit that definition?
So over the last few years, the term mast cell activation has become popular, and for good reason, as far as I'm concerned. So we separate mast cell diseases, and most mast cell diseases have activation, but you'll see where I'm getting it. In three categories. So we have what we call primary mast cell disorders. And those would be systemic mastocytosis or cutaneous mastocytosis or some malignancies. By definition, that means many more mast cells than normal, and they misbehave as well. Then we have the secondary mast cell disorders, which is the kind of the bread and butter of many of us, which is allergy, asthma, rhinitis, you know, eczema. And then we have the idiopathic, which means we don't know what on earth they are. Some is idiopathic edema. Some might be idiopathic anaphylaxis. So it's not clear immunoglobulin E. And then we have the mast cell activation disorders. And unfortunately, many of our colleagues focus on what is called mast cell activation syndrome. And I'll indicate why. But diagnostic codes for insurance companies exist for mast cell activation unspecified and other mast cell activation disorders. So we don't have to get stuck to MCAS, which is mast cell activation syndrome. Why? Because the definition, for better or worse, of mast cell activation syndrome says that you have to have, in addition to history and, you know, other things, tryptase elevation within 40 hours of an episode. Now, tryptase is an enzyme that is found inside the mast cell granules, and most of the time is released together with histamine. And it is supposed to be specific for mast cells. But unless you have an indwelling catheter and you go to a laboratory that knows what they're doing, no one can measure it within 48 hours. In right. fact, I recently had a physician whose wife had some of what appeared to be massive mast cell activation in Florida. And I asked them to go to the clearest or nearest, emergency room. And I told them to use the word potential mastocytosis or mast cell activation. And this was like a month ago. And the emergency room physician asked the lady, what's wrong with your breasts? He had no idea what mastocytosis or mast cell activation was. He probably didn't remember anything from histology. So you see how badly off we can be even now. So if there is mast cell activation, then that has to be addressed because no drug really, not even cromolyn, can block the activation of the mast cells. We have now many good drugs that inhibit the proliferation of the mast cells by blocking an enzyme called, or a class of enzyme called tyrosine kinases, but they don't touch activation of the mast cells. So obviously, if someone has a lot of mast cells, and you bring them down to normal, then what happens due to activation will be reduced because you have actually fewer mast cells. But you can have just a few mast cells going crazy and it will still have a lot of symptoms. And unfortunately, many colleagues don't believe these patients. As you know, probably more than anybody else, they might go through 10 years and as many, you know, health professionals before they come up with someone that understands what is going on. So I usually recommend, especially if they're women, says don't look nice. If you look nice, no one's going to believe you. Just don't sit for 3 days. Don't put makeup on. Look sick. And then just stick with 2 or 3 major symptoms that you have just to get yourself through the door. And then you can kind of open up and say, well, I've got another 20 symptoms. Because otherwise, it's just colleagues just don't believe them for exactly the reason. They do rush, they do skin break, and they're negative. So going back to your appropriate question about other ways the cells are triggered. So number one, in food intolerance, the food intolerance test measure immunoglobulin G, IgG subclass 4. So we can do, and I'm a proponent of doing food intolerance tests, with the following caveat. If you eat something every day, it turns out to be false positive. So I usually tell families, patients, whatever, if you can eat just chicken, boiled chicken and rice for like 3 days, then do the test. Because if you eat something every day, it will turn out positive and we don't know what to exclude, if you wish, or for what to do immunotherapy, if we need to go that route. And this last receptor that I mentioned recently cannot be measured as of yet, but some laboratories, not clinical laboratories yet, have measured soluble receptor. So they can pick up the receptor, it's like shed from the cells in the blood, and if that is present, then one has to treat these patients very differently than just giving antihistamines.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, I read in some paper that the body will make IgG4 as a blocking antibody to IgE. Is it part of the immune mechanism that the body's making these IgG antibodies maybe to protect against anaphylaxis?
I don't know exactly what you're referring to, and I don't want to argue for the following reason. In chronic urticaria, for instance, and 50% of the people that have itching have chronic itching, we measure the presence of IgG antibodies against the receptor, but they're not protective. They're gain of function. They stimulate the receptor. So in that case, it's an autoimmune disease, literally.
Yeah.
Now, there are some reports that say that IgG subclass 1 may be protective. And I usually try to measure IgG1 and IgG4 and see, you know, if the ratio is off. But I did not know that many patients have protective IgG antibodies, but I stand to be corrected.
Okay, yeah, it was a paper I read a while ago, and I was thinking, well, that's kind of interesting, because I know there are some laboratories out there that are specifically measuring IgG4 against versus total IgE.
To give you, I always measure IgG1 and IgG2. I mean, I ask for it. But to give you an example, as you know, I'm very interested in autism in addition to, you know, mast cells and allergies. And there was a very good paper that was published that showed very high levels of IgG4 in children with autism. Now, they did not go further to see, was that related to maybe food intolerance or something else? But clearly it was an indication that something else was high that may be contributory.
Well, you know, we know that mast cells are found throughout the body. You know, some people get GI symptoms, some people get skin conditions. I want to kind of hone in on sort of the brain effects, because I think this is sort of the lesser appreciated effects of mast cells. I mean, we're all familiar with hay fever and asthma and the sort of the typical allergy symptoms. Can you talk a little bit, though, about, you know, what happens to mast cells in the brain? What kind of symptoms might people experience that they might not recognize is actually related to mast cell activation?
Absolutely. First of all, that's very close to my heart because I've been studying it for almost 30 years. And almost 30 years ago, I published a little review calling the mast cells the immune gate to the brain because they regulate the blood-brain barrier. If you can think of the blood-brain barrier as 2 sets of cells, so something from the lumen has to cross 2 sets of cells and another membrane to get inside the brain proper, the mast cells hug the blood-brain barrier. And we published electromicrographs showing that. So if the mast cell is triggered, many molecules, tryptase, histamine, substance B, prostaglandins, will open up the blood-brain barrier. And now molecules that should never have gone into the brain will get into the brain. And that's a problem, obviously. Number two, The mast cells, as I said earlier, are found not only in the meninges, but are found in thalamus, hypothalamus, amygdala, pituitary. And we wrote a review some years back about the neuroendocrine triggers of the mast cells. So the question is, what is it that triggers the mast cells there? I already said that CRH can trigger the mast cells, but for instance, outside the brain, parathyroid hormone is a major trigger of mast cells, and in fact, it can cause intractable itchiness. So if someone is not helped by antihistamines, I will ask, let's measure calcium and parathyroid. And many times, I mean, 1 in 20 times are found actually hyperparathyroidism, and they removed 2 of the 4 parathyroid glands, and they did just fine after. So in the brain, we're still looking to see what might be triggers. Now, once the blood-brain barrier becomes permeable, other classic triggers of the mast cells will trigger those cells as well. But if the brain is not accessible to something from the blood, then there must be triggers inside. So what those might be? Well, viruses. Viruses will trigger the mast cells because they have what we call toll-like receptors, TLRs. In fact, they have receptors, TLR receptors, for fungi, bacteria, and viruses. So if someone has a subclinical meningitis type of problem, the mast cells could be triggered. Any virus that we breathe will go up the nose through the olfactory nerve tract into the brain. So those could be triggering. In fact, as you know, we call those sinuses the death triangle, because if you got infections here, you can get infection into your brain. And we know the coronavirus actually affects the olfactory nerve and most likely affects the brain. And molecules released from either bacteria, mold, or viruses are probably more important. We published a series of papers in the last few months that the spike protein, not the coronavirus itself, can get into the brain and cause havoc. It can stimulate the microglia, it can stimulate the mast cells. And we've just got a paper accepted that one of the major mycotoxins, ochratoxin A, can directly stimulate microglia and mast cells in the brain. So there could be all kinds of triggers that we never thought of. Now, what might be the symptoms? The classic symptom that I never thought of was actually indicated to me by a patient with mastocytosis who was many years ago traveling with me to lecture. And as you know, unfortunately, when you land at some airport, most airports, especially if you're coming from another country, you have to go through duty-free. They force you to go through duty-free.
Yeah.
And this lady was absolutely sensitive to perfumes. And she would freak out, not only because she had physical symptoms, she became aggressive. And that's what she called then, and I've been using the term ever since, mastopsychosis. So people really respond in ways that you never expect and never expected themselves. So we've seen a lot of neuropsychiatric symptoms, all the way from psychosis, frank psychosis actually, to of course things like anxiety, brain fog, irritability, and peripheral neuropathies. So tingling, for instance, like you might have, you know, sometimes, you know, when you go to the emergency room, they might think you've got a mini stroke, you know, TIA, transient ischemic attack, or you might have migraine headache, you know, that kind of thing. So it can be very confusing. And I've had patients having a lot of such symptoms when they're exposed actually to what we call, you know, sick home or house sick syndromes, you know, mold infected. And right. You don't have to look and find the mold necessarily, because the mycotoxins are volatile. They stick to carpets, you know, clothes, you know, drapes, you know, whatever. And I wrote an editorial where I mentioned what I'm about to tell you, but I think it's quite important. In the Bible, you know, 4,000 years ago, the rabbi said, and I know the exact, you know, quote, if you walk into a house that is moldy, you tear it down. If you walked into a house and you came out, you burn your clothes. They were way ahead of us. and we just don't pay that much attention to it, unfortunately. Yesterday, I was talking to a family from Europe, there's two children, two of your four children are actually on the spectrum, autistic spectrum. And they said their home is covered with mold. They live very close to a swamp, they're close to a river, like 90% humidity every day long. So for those families, of course, no one can afford it necessarily. I'll then just get out of there. I mean, there isn't much we can do unless you really get yourself somewhere else. So.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting as you're describing this, you know, about how mast cells basically break down the blood-brain barrier. You know, again, I'm somebody living with MS. And when you look at the pathophysiology, sort of how MS starts, it's interesting when you read the medical textbooks, the first event is a breakdown of the blood-brain barrier. Now, nobody will tell you why. It just says, we know there's a breakdown in the blood-brain barrier, and then there's a recruitment of activated T cells that then target the myelin, which is the crux of MS. So is, you know, if we're having this conversation, I'm thinking, boy, how much of, at least with MS or maybe other neurodegenerative disease, really starts with some sort of mast cell activation at the blood-brain
Absolutely.
It's that ball rolling.
I have to give credit to colleagues from Sweden. They published 50 years ago that in tissue from individuals who had died with MS, when they looked, there were mast cells all around the MS lesions. They were the first to say that 50 years ago.
Wow.
So they didn't pay attention to that. That's number one. Number two, with Dr. Hauser, who has been chair of neurology at Stanford for many years, but he used to be at the Mass General Hospital, and we worked together. We had measured in the cerebrospinal fluid tryptase in either remitting relapsing MS or chronic MS or otherwise other neurologic conditions. That was almost 15 years ago. And we found that tryptase was elevated in the cerebrospinal MS patients, and that can only come from brain mast cells, because otherwise, peripheral mast cells, you know, et cetera. So there was another indication that the mast cells are involved. I get you the chicken and the egg, but they're involved. Then we published a paper that went under the radar screen for many, many years, probably still under the radar screen. But we were inducing in rats and mice experimental allergic encephalomyelitis. And as you know, what you do in this case, you take myelin fragments. One is called MOG with a number because it's a particular fragment. You immunize the animals, and nothing happens. And what we did was we put the animals into a plexiglass immobilizer. Just 15 minutes. They can see, they can smell, they can breathe, obviously, but they cannot move. For just 15 minutes, a week later, they were paralyzed. So just the stress opened up the blood-brain barrier and allowed the now sensitized T cells to get into the brain and recognize myelin and destroy it. So just 15 minutes stress in otherwise normal animals. And I remember I had a patient from Brussels who traded diamonds in Kazakhstan. And he would come back, he had multiple sclerosis, and he would come back and he would be like a basket case. I mean, horrible symptoms. And I said, can you tell me what happens when you go up there? Well, he says, I've got bags of euros or dollars or whatever, and I've got bags of, you know, diamonds, and they're Kalashnikovs all over the place, and I don't know if I will ever actually make it alive. I said, you're crazy. Just drop what you're doing and go live in the Bahamas or Greece or somewhere, you know? I had patients who the stock market will go down and the multiple sclerosis will be all over the place. So we know that. And I published a review about stress and multiple sclerosis. So I'm very, very, very strong proponent of take care of stress, however we do that. So, for instance, one of the things I recommend is the herb ashwagandha. It's not a very strong one, but it takes the edge off. You know, before you get to benzodiazepines, which I don't like because they make your muscles a little floppy, and then you don't quite know whether it's the MS or the drug.
Right.
I also like propranolol, the antihypertensive drug, unless you have asthma, because I consider it one of the best anxiolytics without bothering your mental ability or your muscles. And you can, if you have an oximeter, you can follow it because you can follow your pulse. Usually propranolol will drop your pulse. So, you know, if you're 120, my goodness, you shouldn't be there. You should be at 70. So you can gauge it. But I always, not only for any complex disease, I'm a proponent of taking care of the stress, you know, with whatever I can before you get to the benzodiazepines. And that goes for MS for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, I know one of the strategies that you've looked at, you know, with your company and your research is mast cell inhibition. So like Correct. I said, antihistamines, leukotriene inhibitors like Singulair, these are dealing with the after effect. The mast cell's already done its job. It's released all these granules, all these chemicals are all circulating in the bloodstream. But mast cell inhibition is about trying to stop the balloon from popping in the first place.
Correct. Yes. So we published the first review in 2000, actually, in pharmacological reviews, and it's become sort of, you know, classic in pharmacology. There are 3,000 natural molecules that belong to the class of flavonoids. Sometimes they're called anthocyanidins. That's a bigger one, and then you go further down, et cetera, et cetera. And not all of them are good. To give you an example, you know, if God forbid you've got breast cancer that is estrogen sensitive, you don't want to take soy bioflavonoids because it will stimulate the receptors. So just to give you an example, that not all of them are good. Then we separate them in those that are more antioxidant and those that are more anti-inflammatory. And it might not be apparent, but think of the flavonoids as the rings of the Olympic Games. You know, you've got three rings. And at the sides, at the end, you've got, for plain speaking, waters, hydroxy groups. The more hydroxy groups you have, the more antioxidant you are. So pycnogenol, for instance, has 15 such hydroxy groups. So we try, obviously, antioxidant activity is important, but you've got to balance a number of things. Number one, which is going to be metabolized or broken down faster to allow the other one to escape? And especially if we're dealing with the brain, if you have too many waters, you don't get in the brain because you cannot cross the blood-brain barrier. So what we've been doing over years is culturing human cells, mast cells or microglia cells, and then we stimulate them with triggers that are known or suspected triggers, and we measure the outcome, which could be histamine, cytokines, tryptase, leukotrienes, whatever. And in that way, we and others have shown that certain flavonoids can block the mast cells, at least in the laboratory. And quercetin and luteolin have been two of the strongest inhibitors. Now, how do we go from there to humans? Problem number one is we don't know how much to give, because when you give it in a dish, you bathe the mast cells or the microglial cells. In the body, you don't have one compartment. You've got brain, liver, you know, heart, kidneys, etc. So we approximated that you need about 500 to 1,000 milligrams per 80 kilogram, you know, individual, but to reach the blood, that level, but only 10% are absorbed from the gut in powder form. So we then search to see if we mix the powders with oils and we give them energy, that creates what is called liposomes. Some people call that liposomal preparations. And we found out that olive oil was one of the best, and you will be getting your Mediterranean diet, if you wish, at the same time. And olive pomace oil, which comes from the beet, was actually about 10 times cheaper. So we ended up using olive pomace oil. The French call it olive fruit oil. Sounds a little better. So, but nevertheless, we increased the absorption 3 to 5 times. So we created small soft gel capsules, not hard, where 50% is the oil, the other 50% is the content, and that gives you higher absorption. And we combined most of the time quercetin and luteolin, because quercetin is broken down in the liver faster because of its structure than luteolin, to allow luteolin to escape and get into the brain, which, because it has fewer hydroxy groups, is likely to get into the brain. But with every individual is different, because of the size, because of how the gut works. If someone has diarrhea, you're going to be able to absorb it. So then what we thought is, well, what do we do for patients that have a lot of skin problems? Of course, if we manage to inhibit the mast cells systemically, then we reduce the problem. but can we actually do it locally? Well, unfortunately, quercetin and luteolin are yellow, and therefore we couldn't create a yellow cream. But we found out that if instead of waters, you have methyl groups, and we call that methoxynuteolin, there's no color, because the color depends on the hydroxyl groups. So we identified and purified methoxynuteolin, and we put in a skin lotion along with aloe vera and some other normal ingredients, and the cream is called Gentle Derm. It's very hydrating, entirely hypoallergenic, and it's got the same component. So you can use it 2-3 times on particular parts of the skin while you're using the luteolin-containing product. And just to make sure that I cover the field, so to speak, I'm at absolute loss why many colleagues say, well, if it's not absorbed, I'll give you 3 grams, 5 grams a day, if let's say quercetin. What happens is you absorb 10%, all of the rest stays in the gut, shuts down your bioflora, and you create SIBO, you start chasing your tail.
Right.
So it's much more important to use a liposomal preparation, whether it's the ones that I help create and the company is called Algonaut, A-L-G-O-N-O-T, or you can find them on Amazon, or some other liposomal preparation. So it's better to have smaller amounts and make sure it gets absorbed than giving much more amount that is not absorbed and then shutting down your gut, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I got to give a shout out. You know, one of the products of the company we work with is called Algonaut, A-L-G-O-N-O-T, I believe. Mm-hmm. And the product's called NeuroProtec with a K at the end, LP, which means low phenol. And it's a combination of quercetin, rutin, and luteolin. And I've used this with, I mean, now hundreds of patients since the inception. I can't remember how long it's been since the product's been out. And I mean, I've had great results with my patients. We've used a lot with my kids with autism in terms of modulating behavior, reducing their classic allergic symptoms, their eczema. I've used it with my asthma patients. And, you know, people have responded, you know, quite well to this combination of bioflavonoids. So I think it speaks to, you know, what you're talking about in the research as a very effective yet safe way to help stabilize these cells so that people don't end up right. With all downstream effects.
Two additional points that I would like to make there is one, that as you know, children many times cannot swallow pills or capsules. So now the neuroprotectlofino is actually in liquid in dropper bottles. So one dropperful is roughly equivalent to one capsule. And if you squeeze it under the tongue, it literally becomes sublingual, and then you can absorb almost all of it. Well, you'll swallow some, but nevertheless. The other thing that I want to point out is something that does not show up on dietary supplements. Number one, Algonaut is actually FDA registered. That means FDA inspects the company every 2 years. Companies that sell dietary supplements don't have to do that. No one requires that. Second is it's got actually a food license from the state of Florida. So we get inspected by them as well. Number three, the cheapest source of quercetin, especially, or such flavonoids, is either peanut shells, and no one tells you that, so if you're allergic to peanuts, you're doomed, or from fava beans. And as you know, about 15% of Mediterranean extraction people lack the enzyme G6PD, glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase, and if you eat something that came from fava beans, you can get hemolytic anemia, and then you're trying to find out, you know, what is going on. And the last part is the purity. The FDA published a paper about 2 years ago where they inspected various supplements, not flavonoid-containing, supplements in general. 65% of the supplements had zero of what they claimed on their label, zero. So it's very important to try. I know the consumer doesn't have the time to do that, but at least ourselves as health professionals should. And I always look at everything that is in there. For instance, many of the patients that have allergic histories respond adversely to titanium dioxide or silicon. So, but most of these things do contain these. Many products and supplements, as you know, contain mammalian-derived products. Like even chopstick has mammalian-derived products. Why do I say that? Because in all mammalian products, especially from cow, from beef or pork, contain a molecule called alpha-gal. And many patients now are allergic to alpha gal. I've had patients who turn red, and it wasn't allergy to food. It was just it was whatever they were putting around their lip or lipstick, etc. And these are not necessarily disclosed in labels, even in drug labels. So we've got to, you know, I know it's a pain in the neck to be looking at every inactive ingredient, but many of these inactive ingredients, in fact, are very active in some of the patients that we're dealing with.
Well, I think that speaks to a bigger problem in the supplement industry as a whole. What we're finding is a lot of the, I think what I consider the good supplement companies are getting bought by drug companies. They're getting bought by private equity firms.
Correct.
Who don't understand the business. They're just looking at the bottom line. And then sometimes that means they start swapping out the hypoallergenic ingredient for a cheaper ingredient, like you said, titanium dioxide or something else that people might be sensitive to. And as a doctor, of course, it's so frustrating when we've got good products that we see change over time because there's a new owner who's looking
at
the origin versus quality of the supplement.
And in fact, I don't understand why products that are designed to help people with allergies have color. Like Benadryl is red. You know, I cannot, it exists in clear capsules. Yeah. But I swear I cannot find it. I've got to go to five pharmacies to find clear capsules of diphenhydramine.
Yeah.
And the same goes true for others, you know, presumably to indicate dosing. I don't care about the dosing if it's going to cause a problem with the patient.
Yeah.
There's a company that says sells folinic acid, which is sort of high-octane folic acid, if I can call it that. But that is color, and a lot of patients respond to that. So we really have to be very cognizant of a number of these, because these complex patients, my God, I've got patients who cannot tolerate water, bottled water. And as it turns out, one particular plastic releases, you know, molecules that these patients are sensitive to. So we switch to glass water now. So everything has to be actually, unfortunately, considered a potential trigger until proven otherwise.
Yeah, and certainly we see people in clinical practice, they become so hypersensitive to their world that everything bothers them. Every chemical, every perfume, every scent, every little molecule. Like I said, it doesn't take much. This idea, well, it's just a little. It's just a little. But if you're hypersensitive, it's like if you had a true peanut allergy, you wouldn't give somebody a little peanut.
That little peanut
will kill them. So
there are some other natural molecules that have some sporadic publications that might block mast cells. And I'll mention just one for today, but berberine. I've used berberine because it's got antiviral, antibacterial properties, etc. I use it quite a bit for people that have been exposed to mold because it does have antifungal properties. But recently, there were two papers within the last year that it also blocks mast cells. So if someone cannot tolerate anything else, that might be a possibility. But then if you buy the berberine, it doesn't come as a clear single item. It's got all kind of other fillers. So one might have to, you know, go the route of compounding something for many of these patients, as you know better than me. But we do continue. I haven't given up. We're still struggling. And I'll let you with the following experiment that we're doing, which I wanted to do for 40 years, but no one wanted to fund it. And to me, it seems so obvious. A paper was published by a wonderful group out of Charité in Berlin, Dr. Zuberier and Maurer, some years ago, and I was asked to write an editorial. What they did is they purified mast cells from either foreskin or from breast tissue from otherwise normal individuals. They're absolutely normal. And they stimulate them with the same allergic trigger. There was 100-fold difference in reactivity of the mast cells. Same tissue, normal individuals, which means that not all the mast cells behave the same in an otherwise quote-unquote normal individual.
Yeah.
So now, take you to what we're doing. When I stimulate human culture mast cells in the laboratory, and I can use IgE, an antigen, or I can use a peptide or something else, at any time, about 50% of the cells just don't respond. So when we use, let's say, IgE and antigen, we look to see if all of them had equivalent expression of the IgE receptor, and they did, which means to me that something else is going on in those cells that don't respond. Well, I've tried for years to get funded to analyze what is it different in those cells that I call responders versus those that I call non-responders. Because you find out that non-responders have maybe an innate inhibitor. Why would God nature put the mast cells there without some way to block them? So now I bit the bullet and I did some preliminary results, and we're writing a grant for February 15th for NIH. It's what they call high risk, high outcome kind of research. Who knows? But we've got to start thinking outside the box rather than, you know, creating yet another type of antihistamine or another type of antileukotriene. And unless we go to the bottom line, what is it that allows the cells to be so responsive or non-responsive, I don't think we'll get any. So that's kind of the approach we're taking.
Well, good luck on that. I know this research is desperately needed. I mean, as a clinician, you know, we see more and more people that are more hypersensitive to the world. It's not getting better. The rates of allergy, asthma, eczema, all these allergic illnesses are getting worse and worse. And like I said, the things that have been used for decades aren't working as well. We need other strategies. So I'm glad that there's folks like you out there on the front lines of research, you know, trying to figure out ways to help us clinicians better treat our patients. So before I close out, I just want to direct people to, you know, Algonot. You know, if you've been struggling with, you know, allergic illness, mast cell activation, you know, I like that all your products are geared around mast cells in some way, shape, or form. Correct. You know, the Gentle Derm, a nice topical for different, you know, eczema, allergic illnesses. Again, I love the NeuroProtect. I've used it for however long it's been out. And you and I were talking before we jumped on camera here about another product called Brain Gain.
You can Brain Gain has the same luteolin, a higher amount than other, but it contains another five ingredients that help, especially brain cells, survive, be in better health, respond differently. And, you know, you're probably going to laugh at this, but I, you know, I'm Daryl, I'm 74. I still put 10 hours a day at least. And I've been taking 4 Brain Gain a day for years. So if nothing else, I think it really helps me. You focus better. You can multitask easier. So I can imagine if it helps someone like myself, it's more likely to help people than might have sort of falling behind a little bit in terms of, you know, mental acuity, cognition, et cetera. So at least it's self-tested. And I didn't grow any horns. So.
Well, I know you and I could go on for hours. There's so much more to talk about. I think I'm going to have you back on the podcast so we can talk more about mast cells. I think it's so important. So again, I'm always grateful that you spend time with me. I always learn so much every time I talk to you. So
thank
just
you, really Darren. It's been a pleasure. And by the way, in about 2 weeks, there will be a much more simplified website than the one I have. My site is mastcellmaster.com, and it's got a lot of information. So it's hard to navigate sometimes. There will be a site called drtheoharides.com where there will be a lot of rubrics. You know, how do we diagnose something? You know, how do we go around, you know, dealing with it? I don't want to say treating it, you know, et cetera. And a lot of Q&As. So I've got about 100 questions from various people, various walks of lives, and I answer them. So many of the questions that some of our listeners might have wanted to ask me or you maybe, they'll find it actually in that site. And I'll very much appreciate any comments because I would like it to make it very easy and very accessible to people out there.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely, I think by the time this gets ready to roll out, you should be up and running with the new site. So we'll drop the link in the notes and so people have a way to check it out. So again, Dr. Theo, again, I really am grateful.
Thank you very much. Very much. Do come back soon. I'd love to talk to you again soon. So
great. All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Theo.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.